The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles principally from the Harvard Health Letter. And the first article comes from the Harvard Health Letter of July 2024, and it's entitled Best Ways to Recover from a Muscle Strain. You didn't listen to your body when it screamed for you to stop scrubbing the floor on your hands and knees. Or to quit playing pickleball. Now you're dealing with aching muscles that have left you in more pain than you expected. Be careful, you might have a strained muscle. What is a muscle strain? Normally, challenging your muscles is good for them. It creates microscopic damage in the muscle tissue, prompting the body to make repairs and build muscles back bigger and stronger. You might feel sore for a day or two, but the pain will go away. Putting excessive stress on muscles, however, can overstretch or tear muscle fibers. The resulting injury is called a muscle strain or a pulled muscle. The damage could be a small nick or a lesion on muscle tissue. In severe cases, the muscle can rip into two separate pieces. A strain can happen with a single motion, like reaching way out of bounds for a ball or using a dumbbell that's too heavy for you, or repeated motion, like back and forth arm movements or scrubbing the floor. You'll know if you suffered a severe strain. You'll most likely hear an audible pop and see a dent in the outline of the muscle. You'll feel immediate pain, swelling, tenderness, and weakness. You might even have bruising. Less severe strains can be mistaken for sore muscles initially, since both can be tender and painful. How can you tell the difference? If the pain is in a large area, like your entire back, it's probably due to sore muscles responding to a new activity. If the pain is localized to one specific area of your back, that's a strain, says Brianna Williams, a physical therapist at Harvard-affiliated Spalding Rehab Hospital. If the pain eases by day three, you probably just have sore muscles, Williams says. If the pain intensity has increased by day three, you probably have a strained muscle. If you have severe muscle pain, see your doctor right away. You might need to immobilize the injured muscle or have it repaired surgically if it has been torn. If pain is not severe and you're unsure whether a muscle is strained or just sore, wait it out and use these strategies. First of all, you should follow the RICE rules, R-I-C-E. RICE stands for rest, ice, compression, and elevation. In this case, rest the injured muscle by taking a temporary break from intense activities, but continue normal activities like getting dressed or walking your dog. Ice the injured area for 20 minutes at a time, or use heat if it's more comfortable for you. Compress the muscle with an elastic bandage and elevate the injured area. Massage the muscle or apply topical pain creams containing menthol. The body has trouble experiencing more than one sensation at a time in a single area. Introducing pressure or menthol helps to disrupt pain signals. You should also consider medication, over-the-counter acetaminophen or Tylenol, ibuprofen or Advil or Motrin, or naproxen, Aleve, can provide additional pain relief, unless your doctor has advised against taking these medications. Gentle stretching can promote healing by reestablishing the normal length of the muscles. But don't overstretch. If you feel worse after stretching one day, do a gentler stretch the next time. You should also get enough sleep. This is when your body repairs muscles. Aim for 7 to 9 hours per night. And try to keep up your protein levels. At each meal, include a serving of protein like fish, poultry, dairy, nuts, seeds, or beans, which helps build muscle. To find out your total daily protein needs in grams, multiply your weight in pounds by 0.36. Stay hydrated. Water can aid recovery by helping cells flush out waste products. Try to drink water throughout the day and routinely eat water-rich foods like fruits, vegetables, smoothies, and soups. Try isometric exercise. If it's not too painful, gently contract or squeeze the injured muscle for 30 seconds at a time. This promotes the normal breakdown and reknitting of muscle tissue. If muscle pain persists after 3 days to a week, see your doctor. When pain subsides, return to intense activity gradually and stretch muscles regularly to keep them long, supple, and healthy. And the next time your body begs you to take a break from activity, do your best to listen. Now, our next article from the Harvard Health Letter is the Ask the Doctor segment with Dr. Anthony Komaroff, who's the editor-in-chief. And the question is, my friend, a fitness nut, tells me that regular exercise protects me against COVID and other illness. Since I'm terrified of infections, that might just finally get me to exercise regularly. Is she right? Well, get yourself some gym clothes and walking shoes, because your friend almost surely is right. There have not been a lot of studies conducted to see if exercise protects against infections, but there have been a few, and they all point in the same direction. The largest study, which was conducted here at Harvard Medical School, was published in JAMA Network Open in February 2024. The study included 62,000 people aged 45 or older. They were followed from before the start of the COVID pandemic in the early 2020 through the end of 2022. Information was collected about many factors that could affect a person's vulnerability to infection, like chronic illness, socioeconomic status, and lifestyle factors. The study also tracked whether people got COVID and how seriously ill they were with the COVID. Finally, the study determined how physically active people were. 69% were sufficiently active, meaning their weekly activity level was in the healthy range, at least 150 minutes per week of moderate to vigorous physical activity. As for the rest, 11% were insufficiently active, and 20% were inactive. The study conclusively showed that compared to people who were inactive, those who were sufficiently active were 10% less likely to develop COVID and 27% less likely to be hospitalized for COVID. This was particularly noticeable among women. Unfortunately, people who were insufficiently active did not do much better than those who were completely inactive. You really need a healthy amount of physical activity every week to be protected against COVID. Not surprisingly, this study also showed that people who got a COVID vaccine were much less likely to get COVID and to be hospitalized. Other studies have shown that regular exercise protects against other infections, like influenza, so the results of this study are not really surprising. And as we often report, regular exercise protects you against heart disease, cancer, dementia, depression, and other major illnesses. How does regular exercise achieve these healthy benefits? Science is just beginning to learn the answer. Exercise enhances the ability of several types of white blood cells to fight infection. It stimulates the body to produce antibodies in the lining of the nose, throat, breathing tubes, and lungs, which fights infection. At the same time, regular exercise keeps the immune system from overreacting to infection and waging a battle that injures not just the invading germ, but also the body itself. You've heard it before in these pages. No pill ever invented protects your health as much as does regular exercise. Now, here's another interesting article from the Harvard Health Letter of July 2024, and it's entitled, Do You Really Have a Drug Allergy? If you've always thought you had a medication allergy, there's a chance that you actually don't. Quite frequently, people are mistaken about such conditions. As many as 10% of people who say they're allergic to penicillin, a large class of antibiotics used to fight infections. But studies suggest that 90% of these people don't have true penicillin allergies. Having inaccurate information in your medical record can interfere with your medical care, so it's time to take a look at drug allergies and find out if you need to set the record straight. What's a drug allergy? Drug allergies occur when your immune system responds to a medication as if it were a harmful enemy and prepares to attack it. You might not develop any symptoms when you first take the drug, but your immune system will gear up for the possibility of the drug's return. If you take the medication again, your cells will go on the attack, causing a range of symptoms. You could have a mild rash, itching, or hives that develop in a day or two or up to a week later. Or you might have severe symptoms that appear within hours, like hives, a rash, itching, nasal congestion, a rapid pulse, a drop in blood pressure, difficulty breathing, facial swelling, dizziness, and lightheadedness. These symptoms indicate a life-threatening emergency called anaphylaxis and warrant an immediate call to 911. Not all symptoms caused by medications represent allergic reactions. Most symptoms are caused by direct effects of the medication on the body's tissues and don't involve your immune system. Such symptoms include rashes, nausea, headache, drowsiness, confusion, dizziness, vomiting, an upset stomach, diarrhea, and more. For example, the antibiotic amoxicillin can cause a rash. In the old days, when kids with ear infections were typically given antibiotics, a lot of them got rashes. Their parents might have interpreted that as an allergy and entered it into a child's medical history, says Dr. Suzanne Salomon, Associate Chief of Gerontology at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Such side effects, which often indicate intolerance to the drug, can be avoided if you stop taking the drug or lower the dose. An allergic reaction is an immune system response. The immune attack often requires strong medications to tamp it down. When you report a medication allergy to your doctor, that drug and closely related drugs will come off the list of possibilities that can be prescribed to you. The loss of those options can lead to treatment challenges. If your doctor doesn't know if you have a true penicillin allergy, he or she can't prescribe any penicillin derivatives or drugs from a related class of antibiotics called cephalosporins. That's because many people who are truly allergic to penicillin are also allergic to cephalosporins. So we have to use other substitutes, and many of them have potential problems. They might not be strong enough, they might be too strong, or they might have a risk of causing additional problems. For example, if you have a mouth or dental infection and you can't have penicillin or cephalosporin, clindamycin is a common substitute. It's in a different class and it's effective, but clindamycin has a greater risk of causing Clostridium difficile-related colitis compared to other antibiotics, Dr. Salomon says. If you've been told you have a drug allergy, Dr. Salomon says it's best to confirm that with an allergist, not just because the information might be wrong, but also because true allergies can fade away as we get older. The allergist will perform a skin test to check for allergies. Where it's possible, you'll get a very small dose of the medication in question, and the doctor will stand next to you with antidotes in case you have a true allergic reaction. You'll get answers, Dr. Salomon says, and if it turns out you're not allergic to a particular drug, we'll be able to return it to your list of medication options, should you ever need it. Now, here's a very important article from the Harvard Health Letter, and it's entitled, New Approaches to Colorectal Cancer Screening. It could be time for a collective sigh of relief, or at least a fingers-crossed kind of hope, because the process of screening for colorectal cancer might soon get easier. The latest evidence shows that a simple blood test offers promise as a CRC screening tool, and that's significant since many people shy away from current screening methods like colonoscopy or a stool test because they can be unpleasant and time-consuming. Skipping the screenings can have deadly consequences. Colorectal cancer is one of the most common causes of cancer death in the United States. Here's what the new blood test might mean for colorectal cancer screening. The blood test is called SHIELD, S-H-I-E-L-D, made by Guardant Health. The test looks for DNA fragments shed by CRC tumors. SHIELD is already commercially available with a doctor's order, but it's not FDA approved and it's not covered by insurance. That could be changing. An industry-funded study published March 14, 2024, in the New England Journal of Medicine evaluated SHIELD's accuracy on more than 7,800 adults who were also undergoing colonoscopies. All of the participants were at average risk for colorectal cancer. Overall, SHIELD accurately identified 83% of colorectal cancer cases. The test wasn't great at finding precancerous growths called polyps. SHIELD found only 13% of advanced polyps, and about 10% of the time the test gave a falsely positive result in people who did not have colorectal cancer or polyps. Still, if SHIELD receives FDA approval, which could happen this year, the test might be a game changer for people who can't or don't want to have other types of screenings. It's not the best test from a performance point of view, but it's better than no test because it might pick up colon cancer before it spreads. And if it can be done on a large scale because it's easier than other screening methods, that would make it the holy grail of cancer screening. But it's too early to tell if that will happen, says Dr. Lawrence Friedman, a gastroenterologist and the Fried Chair of the Department of Medicine at Harvard-affiliated Newton Wellesley Hospital. Stool tests don't require you to get your blood collected at a laboratory or a doctor's office. Stool tests come in a kit that your doctor prescribes. You complete the collection in the privacy of your home and send the sample to your doctor's office or a lab. There, it's analyzed for signs of colorectal cancer, like tumor DNA or tiny amounts of blood from tumors or polyps. The U.S. Preventative Services Task Force recommends three types of stool tests. The first is a guaiac fecal occult blood test, or GFOBT, which uses chemicals to find blood in the stool. This test needs to be done once a year. Then there is a fecal immunochemical test, FIT, which uses antibodies to detect blood in the stool. It also must be done once a year. Then finally, there's the multi-target stool DNA test that's called Cologuard, also known as a FIT DNA test, which identifies DNA from cancer cells in the stool and has a FIT component to look for blood. Remember, FIT means fecal immunochemical test. This test must be done every 3 years. Of the three, the FIT DNA test, that's the Cologuard, is the most effective and currently most accurate, much more accurate than the blood test. It identifies 92% of colorectal cancer cases and 42% of advanced polyps. Its false positive rate is about 13%. The next generation of the Cologuard FIT DNA test, which is awaiting FDA approval, is even better. It can find 94% of colorectal cancer cases and 43% of advanced polyps. According to a recent study in the March 14, 2024 issue of the New England Journal of Medicine, it has a false positive rate of about 10%. The most comprehensive CRC screening is a colonoscopy, which allows your doctor to peer inside your colon and rectum. This type of screening finds 95% of colorectal cancer cases. It's not perfect, but it's more accurate than a blood or stool test. The doctor can find and remove potentially precancerous polyps on the spot and prevent future cancer. Unfortunately, getting a colonoscopy requires a lengthy, uncomfortable prep to clean out the gut so your doctor can see the walls of your colon and rectum clearly. The procedure usually takes place in an outpatient surgery center. During the colonoscopy, while you're under sedation, the doctor places a flexible tube which carries a tiny camera and surgical equipment through the rectum and into the colon. After the screening, you must spend time in a recovery room and then get a ride home. It's time-consuming and it can be expensive, depending on your insurance. The Affordable Care Act requires that Medicare and private insurance pay all the costs of a colorectal cancer screening, a colonoscopy, or one of the recommended stool tests. However, if you opt for a stool test and find something suspicious, you'll need a follow-up colonoscopy, which is considered a diagnostic test. Diagnostic colonoscopies aren't covered completely by insurance and can cost hundreds to thousands of dollars depending on your plan. Because they also enable the doctor to remove precancerous polyps, they can also be life-saving. What if you don't have insurance? Costs for one of the stool tests range from about $30 to $600. Costs for colonoscopies can range from $1,200 to $4,800. The Shield blood test is $895 and patients have to pay the entire fee. If Shield receives FDA approval, the price would likely go down. But a suspicious finding from the blood test requires a colonoscopy follow-up, which racks up more costs. As exciting as a simple blood screening for colorectal cancer may be, we still have many unanswered questions about it. For example, we don't yet know how often screening would be necessary. The manufacturer recommends a test be taken every 3 years, like the FIT-DNA test, but there's not yet a formal recommendation for the blood test. For a colonoscopy, someone at average risk should get the screening about every 10 years. It's also unclear if a blood test would truly be cost-effective, given its false positive rate, or if it would be truly convenient. If you have to get a blood test every few years, but you only need a colonoscopy every 10 years, the time commitment and logistical aspects might actually even out, Dr. Friedman says. We also don't know if the blood test would work well in younger people. In the 2024 study of SHIELD, participants were aged 45 to 84. And remember, SHIELD is the blood test. Where does that leave us? Well, at the very least, we can be confident that we already have good colorectal cancer screening tests, and hopefully that a simpler screening method might be on the way. Many people would probably prefer a blood test for colorectal cancer screening, but it's not quite ready for prime time. The current findings about SHIELD need to be confirmed by more studies, Dr. Friedman says. Do I think a stool or blood test will ever be as good as a screening test as a colonoscopy? I'm not sure, because there's no substitute for getting a good look inside the colon. And not all cancers shed genetic material that shows up in the blood. But who knows? Maybe we'll find a marker one day that's always present before a cancer is discovered. Ultimately, the best test to screen for colorectal cancer is the one that you will get done. And how do you reduce your risk? Well, of course, the older you get, the higher your risk is going to be. But other things that increase your risk include having polyps in the colon diagnosed in the past, past radiation to the pelvis or abdomen, a family history of colorectal cancer, obesity, diabetes, or inflammatory bowel disease, certain hereditary conditions like Lynch syndrome, a sedentary lifestyle, a diet rich in fatty foods or red meats, a low blood level of vitamin D, and smoking or heavy alcohol use. Some of these risk factors like age, family history, and certain diseases can't be changed, but you do have some control over your lifestyle, so you should start exercising every day, even if it's just for a few minutes. Eat a healthy diet rich in fiber and low in red meat and ultra-processed junk foods. Try to lose weight if you need to. Limit your alcohol consumption to no more than one drink per day for women and one or two drinks for men. And if you smoke, look for a smoking cessation program to help you to quit. Every step you take will help to lower your colorectal cancer risk and help to ward off many other types of cancer and chronic diseases as well. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.